Hello and welcome to episode 4 of the Rethinking Work podcast. On today's episode, we have Richard Meyer and James Scott, who are two of the three founding members of Stories. Richard's background was with Argent and he worked on the fantastic King's Cross development. James Scott's background was with The Collective and he was a former equity member, and they both decided to set up in 2018, and it's such an interesting podcast, and they're a socially responsible developer, and we grill them why they think they're socially responsible.
Yeah, I thought it was brilliant. I guess it's also worth saying that we're architects at Able Partners, and we kind of solve real estate problems with design and innovation. And the big problem that we are addressing is this changing attitude to work. So this series is about talking to people and understanding what those drivers behind these changing attitudes are. And they're reflecting it in the built environment. I thought it was great.
So enjoy the episode. Go over to our website, ablepartners.co.uk. And we are on Twitter and Instagram at @able_partners. Thanks for listening. Well, we'll just go straight in. So we are joined by the founders of Stories, Richard Meyer and James Scott. And to give you a bit of backstory about this podcast series, it started off as we were looking for a more niche industry focused podcast. But actually what we've realized quite quickly, it's got a really wide audience, and actually we're founders, actually people are really interested in the story of how the company started, and then we'll come more on to our more kind of industry specific questions. But Stories have a very interesting story, and I'd love, do one of you want to describe, because you've been going since 2018,
mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I've done my research. Do you want to give us a bit of backstory and how it started, and then we'll grill you intensely about the whole story?
Absolutely. So there were three of us that started the business, Paul as well. So each of us come from a property background, but quite different. So Richard spent 15 years at Argent and Argent related, but delivering major projects on King's Cross. So amazing, amazing projects. And we all love spending time there. Paul, actually very different background. So he was advising predominantly public sector, third sector, charity sector on how to find the best development partners. And I was formerly at The Collective. So I was chief operating officer there, and helped grow that startup. So different perspectives. And I think actually quite not with a huge amount of pre-existing relationships, found ourselves each independently, not in those organizations, but probably all for the same reasons. A sense of frustration that actually development is this phenomenally powerful tool, but most often it's done in pursuit of maximizing profit and then bolting on benefits for people in order to get what you want to get. And we really firmly believe that we could build a development business that started from the other way around. So identify the opportunities to create great outcomes for people, and then use our skills as developers and property people to bring those to life. And that was sort of the start of the idea for Stories, and hence the name, because it's all about the stories that people create from these places.
And then so you started, and then your first project seemed to happen relatively quickly. Your St. Mungo's project. I mean, from getting your first incredible project, that didn't take very long, seemingly, from an outsider's perspective.
We almost set ourselves up on the back of the ability to bid for our first project, which is with St. Mungo's. We took advantage of an opportunity where we'd identified something that could fit really well with, you know, having this sort of social responsibility, this outcomes focus. This is what St. Mungo's is, being about, you know, how can you tackle homelessness? How can you particularly tackle it and support it in Westminster, where it's most acute in the UK, and so on? And so it sort of fitted very well with what we were trying to do, which was to focus on, you know, how do we get really good outcomes from development. And of course, the big outcome from this particular opportunity was to re-provide and recreate an even better new centre for St. Mungo's, to help them do their job really well, and to do, you know, to help make that happen through facilitating development, so, you know, building homes to support that.
So some of our listeners might not be well versed in what the role of a developer is, or what the role of the consultants or the council are. Could you flesh out a little bit about what that synergy is? There's some sort of private commercial outcome, and then there's some social as well.
So, high level, a developer is doing, you know, a series of different things. A developer is introducing often money, and often skills, in this instance, to another party with land. and working together in, and then in partnership to help deliver, and certainly with our focus, really good outcomes for that landowner. And you know, we've got a particular focus on community assets and things like that. And so the idea is, you know, we come along, we have a formal agreement with St Mungo's, and what we do is then work with them and co-design with them and work alongside them to develop a scheme that will deliver what they want. But ultimately, to deliver what they want, it's got to be paid for. And to pay for it, we need to undertake other development, because there's no real value from in terms of economic value in that straight sense, from just literally rebuilding a, you know, an end-of-life building for them. So to do that, we need to introduce other development. In this instance, it's, you know, nearly 100 homes rental, some of them affordable as well. And the outcome of that is that that helps to pay for effectively their new building. That's the overall deal, if you like. So it facilitates, it enables them to get, you know, this outcome, and that's the key outcome also for not only them but for Westminster as well.
So governments kind of often force it with it, whether it's a Section 106 or a community infrastructure levy or affordable housing. So what is different about the stories approach here?
It's the perspective, it's the lens of actually starting off. It's not about using, you know, often there's a sort of core model of like, okay, well, I've got money to put in, I want to make an investment, I want to make a return on that investment, I will therefore go and undertake development, and development can create value. And to do that, and along the way, I will secure a planning permission, and to secure a planning permission, I will make commitments. I'll have a wrapper of other ingredients that come in alongside this to enable me to secure that planning, and it might be a contribution to this or a school or that down the road, or a bit of public realm. But for us, it's about saying, actually, what we care about is the outcomes. We're going to start with the outcome, and we're going to shape everything around that, achieving that outcome. And in this instance, it's with the homeless charity St Mungo's, but in other instances, on other early things that we're looking at, it will involve cultural uses or you know, renewing or enhancing them, or indeed, you know, sports or other sorts of things that play a really strong role in the community. And with that, starting with that focus, we build upon, you know, have we got those outcomes. Say, how do we then also do this additional piece, which is how do we minimise risk? And the thing about risk is that risks cost money. And the more risk there is, and often this is what happens in development, the more there is, often more money needs to sort of come out of the development to give a return on that on that risk, be it equity or debt, and all these sort of things. Different forms of way in which we describe money. And so for us, we try really hard to then mitigate the risk. We're trying to actually find ways to reduce risk such that there is effectively less cost of money, and therefore there is the value that is created and unlocked through what we do is then able to be put back in to outcomes, be it social or environmental outcomes as well. And it's a really important thing that starting from the outset feeds through into our whole approach. So, and how we bring other stakeholders and other people along on the journey, and this principle of maximizing stakeholder value rather than shareholder value probably sort of summarizes it reasonably well. But we've been on a journey as well, then we're working with Westminster, so we're in Westminster here, working alongside them and starting with that sort of strong vision from the outset, bringing everyone on that journey and then unlocking therefore a quantum of development that's able to actually support these outcomes actually happening as well. But it's all coming back to what are we trying to achieve that's actually going to be a benefit more widely.
So the reduction of risk is for, I think for a lot, it's fair to say the biggest risk is planning. And you're feeling you're reducing that planning risk by going firm on some of the social outcomes to build trust with authorities?
Well, in part, there's a number of risks. That certainly planning is a risk. And absolutely, you know, ultimately, what if you've got this focus on actually, you know, good outcomes for all the different stakeholders, then yes, we hope and we anticipate that it will help to reduce risk around planning, because actually people are getting what they want rather than somebody forcing a product or something on them that suits their own business model. So there is that. But with development, that is the key thing about it. There are many risks. There's a range of different risks. And you know, funding, for example, is another risk too. And actually what was interesting when we have set up stories, we quite early on started to have a lot of conversations with lots of different sources of money, because all you hear in the press, of course, is about ESG and and or you know this fund is going to be you know this and that, and everyone talks about it, and this is their requirements, and it was really interesting early on to try to understand really what the nature of that money was, and actually was it actually did it really care about what it was doing, or was it box ticking as well? And James could add more to this as well, but certainly about the you know a view that's been held that often it can be the sort of box ticking that's leading the direction of what's going on.
Yeah, we're happy to do it as long as we get our 5%.
Exactly. Know. So exactly that, and that's something that totally concurs.
You're like 2018 when you started. Like stories, like a socially responsible developer was actually quite a. I hadn't heard of that going being that like open about what you were doing. Whereas now you fast forward to 2022, everyone is saying they're a socially responsible developer, and you're like, we've been doing this for quite some time, guys.
Yeah, no, it's you're absolutely right. And
is there anyone you'd like to name and shame now, particularly?
Absolutely not. No, it's actually quite an interesting point though, because we thought long and hard about how we structure ourselves, and we talked about whether we wanted to be a charity or whether we wanted to be a social enterprise. And actually, what we concluded was is that doing good can be good business. And actually, by setting ourselves up as a for-profit business, we're sort of helping to demonstrate to the market that doing it in a way that isn't responsible is sort of no longer acceptable. Because ultimately, if our purpose is to create an environment in which development is delivering these outcomes for people, well, if we can move the whole industry forward so that they're all doing it too, well, that's the biggest legacy we can leave. So I think it's only good that the narrative is changing. What's important now is making sure that people are sincere in what they're doing, rather than just, you know, ticking a box or greenwashing it or whatever equivalent language you want to use.
Yeah, I totally see that. I think there's that sense that people want to, if you can prove that it makes commercial sense, it makes it more difficult not to see projects like this going forward.
Well, ESG's come along and made it very difficult to, because everyone's like, yeah, I love the idea of being socially responsible, but I do want the profit as well. Mm. Whereas now ESG has meant that it's almost, you know, it's so difficult to get access to money unless you are ESG.
I think an interesting observation we've made though is actually there's a shift, and I think COVID has accelerated that shift. And it may be because we've all got a slightly different perspective on things, but I also do think that we're starting to see, you might say, the next generation of leaders coming through. And they are caring more about various other things beyond just maximizing profit. And so that way of thinking is filtering into a lot of these organizations, and organizations are turning around and saying, okay, well what does our strategy look like? And I think we've been really surprised at the amount of people that have come to Stories and said, look, we've got these major, exciting, incredible projects, but the traditional model of let's deliver this financial return and then everything else is secondary. They've sort of said, well, actually, no, we need to consider how we can create greater holistic value. And it's been really interesting to see the kind of organizations that have reached out to
us.
Yeah,
and in a cynical way, if you want to attract the best talent, you've got to be a purpose-led business that walks the walk. And you know, I'm sure you're doing it for the right reasons. It's just a happy coincidence that all the brains and talent want to fall in behind you.
But I think the other thing that we've observed as well is certainly the work that we've been involved in is where we're trying to work with people who have a long-term interest as well. So whether it's a landowner who seeks to be responsible, or whether it's, and often where possible, the investment, the two key ingredients, having that long-term view, that's the thing that probably most unlocks the opportunity to really achieve some really strong outcomes. And I think that that's what we've deliberately sought to do. And these conversations that James talked about tend to be with people who have some of those ingredients as the basis upon what they're, you know, what they're doing. And indeed, you know, indeed, someone goes an example too. So I think that the challenge for the industry in this world of ESG is where you've still got the sort of shorter term sort of real equity driven stuff where, you know, everyone's got to get out in 5 years and stuff like that. And I think that's where it's hardest. That's where that balance is of like, you know, do I invest in this versus that? But a bit of it also isn't about, you know, does it cost me more to do this or that, for example. Some of it might be and is, I guess. But some of it is also just at the end of the day, the people and the management and the structure and being intelligent about the use of resources that you've got and trying to deploy them differently. You know, you can spend, instead of spending money on lots of glossy brochures and marketing, you might spend your money on, I don't know, some form of social initiatives and stuff like that. And in a way, that'll end up doing its marketing for you anyway. So,
we've been discussing the shift between what you see in the press and what you see on social media and what actually goes on with development is not getting more extreme, but you have to be so aware of the public perception of what you're doing, to the point where you know you have to show that you're really doing good, and it is feeding back into the community. And if you get that wrong, the whole development suffers like the worst publicity before it's even started.
I mean, in Dizine today, I read that the M&S on Oxford Street is being reviewed again.
So, oh, really?
Because the whole life carbon assessments, this is probably getting very technical.
No.
But it's that the new guidance by the Greater London Authority is now more extreme, and therefore they're looking again at whether knocking down the flagship building is appropriate.
Things that were not previously public interest now are. And one of the splits we see is you talking to developers in private. Actually, they think that some of the technologies that are going to come in 8-9 years around steel produced with carbon or concrete with a lot less cement, they're actually going to compete with retrofit. And we're absolutely retro first, but the debate is more complex than that, than the headlines can possibly communicate. You touched on using resource. Ben and I worked for a big practice and are now working for a small practice and thinking big and having to use our resource accordingly. You worked for Argent Related, amazing firm, and you know, has a huge impact on the city. And now you are a challenger developer. You've got investment. You've gone on St Mungo's, which is this incredible scheme. How is that working now for number two? Do you have to raise money, or do you have to sit on your hands, or do you mind me asking a little bit about that?
No, it's fine. There's always a challenge when you establish a new business, which is instead of going to somewhere with lots of land and lots of money, you go to somewhere with not a lot of land and not a lot of money, which are your two key ingredients. On the other hand, you have the benefits of having your own values and DNA and baking in how you want to do stuff. And that was the challenge. You know, everyone's been aware of that, the challenge from the outset. So the other challenge with development is that it is very lumpy. So for Stories to have secured a project which is a significant number of millions of pounds, you know, it's of scale, is quite a thing, because it's a you know, startup, or was a small startup business, and that's the thing that weighs heavily on our mind, because in order to have impact, you need to have some scale. And that's almost like, you know, you can have impact clearly on a smaller scale as well, but at the end of the day, we want to deploy our skills and do as much as we possibly can, because everyone wants, you know, is ambitious to help, you know, going back to James's point earlier, change the face of development, actually have, you know, reputation of developers as being trusted and, you know, being a force for good, and not, unfortunately, some of the reputation that exists from decades past. So in terms of looking forward, Stories is actually doing some different things. So one is we actually are, you know, we are acting as a principal developer, and St Mungo's is the most advanced project, but we are also, we've got in the background, can't really disclose at the moment, but there are other initiatives slightly earlier on than that we're also working on as well at the moment. And as you do have this funny thing, as you transition from sort of literally kicking off to, you know, basically your investment, some of it's your own financial investment, but you also do need to introduce others too. And you do start, you sort of kick off at sort of friends and family, and you've kind of got to then grow into trying to formalize that, and that links back to the, you know, get a bit of scale in from others as well. And that links back to my comment earlier about talking to the market and talking to all these investors, and actually whose money is the right money, and, you know, where are they really coming from. And that's been quite interesting, and actually I think we did discover that quite a bit of that money was at one end of the spectrum, which was more about just the boxes, not all of it, and that we're seeing a change in that.
I think the other thing that's quite interesting, when you run your own business, you have the opportunity to maybe take a step back and not perhaps act so instinctively or as you see other business. You know, there is so much attention on hyper growth businesses that get VC money and scale and grow and scale. And in a maybe a slightly perverse way, it's been quite, it's been very helpful to see maybe some of those stories starting to fail. Look at a lot of the investments that someone like SoftBank has made. It's perhaps not as logical anymore to think that a business that can't create profit is a successful business. So I think we're always trying to sort of not be prejudiced by what you read or how you build a business. You know, you can listen to a lot of podcasts and hear a lot of founder stories about growth and all that sort of stuff. So actually being very honest with ourselves what it is that we're trying to achieve, and not compromising that by taking loads of money and then actually being beholden to a misaligned partner, for example.
And we're also, just a sort of final point around that, is that we talked about acting as the principal developer, but also we are working with others as well. So we're sort of providing strategic advice and things like that to others, and who are, you know, who have scale and who are on a sort of change mission as well, and their ambition and purpose is in the right place. So actually that's really interesting, because obviously that affords you a little bit of patience, because it keeps the lights on. Also, it's an opportunity to still have impact, because you're helping to shape and create things. And it's you know, the interesting, you know, really, really interesting challenge, and sort of, yeah, just trying to move, that comes back to that agenda of sort of moving the industry forward more broadly.
We have quite a few students that listen to this, and I think it's worth saying that people sometimes think that developers turn up with lots of money, and actually a development manager might have some money in the game, but they might also be using other people's money, and they will manage, you know, the process of procuring the land, working out what the best use is, pulling together the team, then negotiating the planning process, then tendering it out and finding the right contractor at the right price, then building it, and then marketing that asset. That is a different skill from being an investor or having pots of money. And so there might be a development fee on top of that. I just think that's worth kind of clarifying, because there is a slight distinction. And I can totally see also being an advisor, offering strategic advice, you can't just go in every 4 years when it's time to sort of pull the trigger on another development. You need to know what's happening in the different boroughs, what the sort of changing views of councils are. I totally see the value of staying a part of the strategic.
I might get a kick under the table, but at its core, being a developer...
We'll cut it out if you want.
Exactly. Being a developer is being a brilliant project manager, because great developments come from the input of innumerable stakeholders, both from all walks of life, and it comes from providing leadership. Because what we see, I think, most often is where projects aren't proceeding in the way that many would hope that they would or that they could, is quite often that lack of leadership or that lack of vision, that sort of North Star that everyone knows that they're working towards, because the literally hundreds of thousands of decisions that need to get made on any project, people need the context in which to have confidence to make those decisions. So a developer that can bring great project management and general management and leadership and creativity is what matters.
I've always thought of it as being a sort of facilitator. You know, at the end of the day, there are many, many specialists who are brilliant in many different ways, and that's their focus. And what you've got to do is try to bring them together at the right time and get the best out of them. I think it goes away from the sort of ego that assists with the developer, that the developer is some godly special character, that everything's in a
that's black, Bill, by the way.
Yeah, no one from Australia. Anyway, everything's in a black box, and there's a lot of IP, and everyone's very clever and stuff like that, which has often been the way it's been presented, often to other team members and things like that as well. And I just think that that's totally wrong. It doesn't get the best out of people. It doesn't motivate them. They don't know what they're shooting for.
The servant leader. It's actually like manage the team and bring people on.
Yeah. I guess as well, your background from King's Cross and from Collective. Yeah, because there were such diverse companies, you know, your background has allowed you to be very comfortable working with many different stakeholders. And, you know, you're not at the you know, I won't name any names, but, you know, have a far more direct approach to things. You're used to working with big teams, and I think it's...
I think it's also about realising that life's far richer than just being a developer. I mean, when we started Stories, the conversations we had over a long summer, Richard was in a camper van in somewhere in Europe, homeschooling and potty training his two young daughters. I was very fortunate to be somewhere
not doing that,
yeah, in a 4x4 somewhere between Patagonia and California, where I was doing an amazing road trip and very, very lucky.
Different levels of stress,
and I think I don't quite know what Paul was doing, but every time I skyped him, he was having a glass of whiskey. I think he just had his first child, so that would correspond. But I think the point is, and Bill, we were talking about this just before we started the podcast, there's James Marriott, who's a Times columnist, has talked about the fact that our modern world is very not conducive to creativity, because it's very difficult for us to get into a state of flow, because we've always got these distractions, these notifications, and we're actually so focused on a mindset and a state of hyper productivity that we never create these opportunities for ourselves to think and our minds to wander and to daydream. And I remember, I think it was a presentation by Saatchi, one of the Saatchis that I had a long time ago, that said, he said two things that were really, really powerful. He said, you never hear anyone whistle. Imagine back in the day, you'd been on a train platform, you'd have heard people whistling. And also, he talked about an example of one of his most successful ad campaigns was inspired by standing at a bus stop And this large, hefty lady with her shopping bags trundled across the road, sat down at the bus stop and let rip. And he said, all of my students now who plug themselves in with headphones are missing out on all of this opportunity to be creative. And I think that's, I can't remember why I started talking about this, but I do think that creating that space and that diversity and that outside of your industry is so important in an industry which is ultimately about being creative.
Well, this is what I liked about your article about your not 4-day work week, it's 5 days, but you have a Friday's my day. I think it's such a, like, it's a similar system to, I guess, how we've just naturally progressed. You know, you're flat out all week, and then Friday, you know, you just let you go on a dog walk, then you work till midnight because there's an idea that comes to you later on, and maybe it's easier if you do something on Saturday than it is on Friday. And has that worked? Are you still doing that?
I can't imagine a world in which we aren't doing it, to be honest.
The idea was that, yeah, there was no formal commitment from the business, you know, requirement from the business for you to, you know, turn up at a meeting and do this. There is exception on occasion, but you know, there is, we all live in the real world. But you know, we've stuck to that actually. And, you know, on some Fridays I will work, I will do some work, and actually I'll enjoy peace and quiet. And actually this piece that James was talking about, the chance to, you know, think a bit more as well is very, very valuable because everything is on all the time. And of course everything's on, not just in work, it's in life. With all the notifications, you know, and particularly if there's family or this friend or whatever, you know, you can find your weekend is just lost in all these things. So this bit on this sort of almost like this kind of cushion on the Friday of a bit like, well, actually, if I just want to pull myself out of this for a moment, I kind of can for a little bit. And that has proven value. And it all comes back to that point about being creative and not just turning the handle on stuff, which is inevitably what you do. And all we observe from all our conversation stuff is that there's a real dearth of that. You know, there's a lack of it because people have got into the world of being always on and always managing someone and, you know, catching up with someone and catching up with this. And it's just, you know, it's a real challenge. But we see wider, you know, news and information about obviously even things like the phone and all, you know, the use of it as well. So it's obviously a broader theme, and we're all ultimately addicted to these things. It's quite difficult, but yeah, it has been.
Well, because Bill and I are most prolific on, you're most prolific on your walk back from dropping your kids off, post coffee, on your own walking. I get like 1,000 WhatsApp messages, and I'll be on a dog walk doing notes. I'm like, Bill, we should do this amazing thing next week.
They had this one slide this course I did recently that said, if you're so successful, why are you so busy? And it's really landed with me. It's like, hang on, there's this modern phenomenon that, oh, I'm of such high value because I'm so brilliant that I'm at times in such high demand that being busy is a reflection of my contribution to society. And I think you're great leaders because if you genuinely walk the walk, then the people coming behind you can see that. And I think that setting an example is close to leadership as you can do.
And it's seen, it is, as your observation is that it's just, society sees value as working hard. Everyone kind of puts that, I work so hard, I've been working 12 hours.
I'm late because I'm amazing.
Yeah, that's really good. That's what I did actually, because I was so busy this morning and I was deep down psychologically, and you can go, oh God, you know, you're really on it. He's packing all this stuff in with Tosser probably instead. But no, there is that. Society sort of values hard work. And of course it didn't. And you know, the art of success when you were, you know, going back a few hundred years was that you were sitting around, I don't know,
bathing
or whatever you're doing. You know, you're probably having in a hammam, having your back scrubbed or whatever it was. And you've actually, that's success. But it's not like I've been tied to my desk.
I'm the king of the really ugly segue here, so I'm just going to truncate this because I know time is an issue today. But we spoke to an interesting chap called Sol Rogers about digital twins and the metaverse and what that means. And it just came up in one of the emails when we were preparing for this. And I wondered, you know, we are, as architects, we are thinking more now about user experience and the spatial internet and what our role is going to be for users of the metaverse rather than just bricks and mortars designers. You know, we've all got to pivot before AI comes and takes our livelihoods. And I wondered if that has impacted your business or your projects.
I mean, I've got a few observations, two observations that I want to make. One is that quite often future technologies happen, but then we don't name them how they were named before. So, you know, we don't talk about, for example, when we blur our backgrounds on a Teams call, that isn't this machine learning really good? This image processing. We just say, oh, isn't that blur background feature really good? And so actually, if I look at the metaverse, it's a virtual world that's used to facilitate virtual interaction in its various guises. Now, you know, the adoption of video calls is a form of that. And I think we will continue to improve and iterate the technology towards some future vision, which we're calling the metaverse. But if we ever get there, it won't be called the metaverse. It will just be called, you know, the whatever it will be.
The internet.
Or virtual shopping, or whatever it might, exactly. So I think it's an amazing sort of, actually to one of my earlier points, this having this vision, this North Star for people to work towards and innovate around, but actually we'll slowly get there and then we'll forget that we ever called it the metaverse. So yeah. I think
Facebook have ruined that term now. Like no one wants to call it the metaverse anymore.
Right? Who are Facebook then? Yeah.
We don't, Web 3.0, whatever they want to call it.
But it's I you know, in terms of day to day stuff, it's quite interesting. Yes, it does in terms of, you know, Teams and stuff like that, and evermore being in a virtual world, I suppose. But not so much in the sense of the physical design and so on of the building. And it's quite interesting also, again, working with others, and we talked about some of the other roles we're doing, and actually how, you know, everyone is really trying to grapple with particularly, you know, the digital twin. And, you know, sure, you could, you know, it is now sort of set up where you can go and have some brilliant, you know, building information modeling protocols and requirements such that you can get you can get all of the information in the correct format when you're looking to manage the building and stuff like that as well. So that, you know, you can start to see some of that starting to sort of come through. But in terms of it then going a step on in terms of, you know, in terms of an really intelligent smart building or indeed twins of anything else, I still think there's a little bit of a way to go there. I think in terms of the metaverse thing more generally, it's the classic thing as well, that to the extent it does exist, because of course it does, you can go to all these worlds. You can go to Sandbox or something, or you can go to Decentraland or something like that. You can go buy real estate in it, which is quite an interesting.
Well, so Citizen M have just said that they'll be the first hospitality company to something in Sandbox.
So everyone will have a go at it. At the moment, everything, I mean, I haven't personally spent hours trawling around this thing, but everything you read about it suggests to you that it's that the hardware still isn't up to it compared to the software isn't up to it. You know, it's kind of like being in a video game from about 2005 or something.
Do you remember when they first had TVs and you were like, why would I want to watch a TV?
So at the moment it's kind of like, but you can obviously see there's very large organizations going out there and, you know, Adidas buying a bit of real estate. The challenge, there's all sorts of other dynamics there you don't yet know about, of course, though, because it's not a fixed asset in the same way. It's you know, you can't say, you know, I'm buying something next to this river, because somebody else can go and just go and create another world, another river right next
to it. Well, this is what was interesting about this conversation that unlocked it for me, is that just copying something and saying, oh, I've got my own earth because I've done a save as kind of thing, you can geo-lock it to the real world. So when we look at St. Mungo's and point my smartphone, you can choose what that person then sees. And if you don't buy that and lock it, someone else can say, oh, every time you walk past Mungo's, I'm going to see this horrible image that's an advert for one of your competitors or something. And it seems to me that the locking it...
It's buying the real geospace.
I also don't think it really matters, though, because I could go and replicate Oxford Street in a town in China, but it's not going to be Oxford Street. And similarly, I could go and copy the source code for Facebook.
Might be more successful than Oxford Street at the moment.
and I could build another social media platform, but if it's not got the network to underpin it, then it's not going to work. And that's those same network effects we've seen through, you know, from the start of civilization, and we're going to continue to see them. And so the fact, whether that's in a physical world or a virtual world, that's still going to hold. And it's not, you know, if you try and draw parallels to what people are talking about in the metaverse, buying up real estate in the metaverse, well, we're all very accustomed to people buying up space on a web page. I mean, there's no real difference. It's just a different medium by which to do it.
It's so interesting. When someone uses a reverse metaphor, you just take something really complicated and then go, it's no different than a web page. You're like, oh yeah, it's not really as good as you think it is, is it? I mean, there's definitely going to be amazing things that happen.
It was when Elon Musk said it was just an iPhone strapped to your face that I really thought,
It is. At some point, the iPhone will be embedded in your head. Of course it will, you know, because it's just, you know, this ridiculous thing. I get it out of my pocket, I open it up, I look at it. I've got to try and lock it with my face.
Yeah, why isn't it in my eyeball?
Yeah, it's just, you clearly, and you can see, you know, and often it's the challenge. That was the classic thing with the Google Glass, wasn't it? It was the fact that maybe it wasn't quite there, the software and the hardware, but it was also that just socially, it's the same with with drones, any of these things. Some of the technology then exists, but it's just the social acceptance of it takes longer. And inevitably, all of these things will, I'm sure, happen. But I'd say at the moment, the challenge with the development piece is around the environmental, you know, all these things we talked about earlier in this discussion, is that there's so much to overwhelm all the businesses with actually how we're going to tackle community out there and the world there that's about to implode with our, you know, climate, you know, challenge that we have. And, you know, those are all real things. So at the moment, I think everyone's brains are absolutely sucked into that. So arguably, it will kind of creep up probably to a degree.
I like that. That is the perfect way we're going to end the podcast. You've got to shoot off to a meeting. Thank you so much, guys, for coming on. I really appreciate your time.
Very fantastic. Good. Thank you.